Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now then, we're going to review the Sunday papers on All-Ireland Hurling Final afternoon. We're joined in studio by two men who'll be writing about the game tomorrow in the Irish Independent. We have Vincent Hogan and Colm Keyes with us. I'll run you through the headlines first of all. As you can imagine, a lot of it centred on what's about to kick off at Croke Park. Clash of the Titans, the Sunday Independent lead. Greatest of Rivals have ruled with an iron fist. Dermot Crowe riding the lead there. And beneath that, this is a story which is in various newspapers. Leo Cullen was speaking after Leinster's friendly against Coventry over the weekend, their pre-season friendly. And amidst it all, Cullen considers player minders. We could be better as well in setting them up with having someone there to keep an eye on them, so to speak, said Cullen, talking obviously about the Sean O'Brien incident and the Stanwright incident, and talks about how the club might have done better in how they handle certain situations as well. We might come back to that at some stage, but chaperoning seems to be maybe the order of the day there. The Sunday Mirror Sport lead is yesterday's game between Man City and Spurs. Oh no, it's deja blue. So once again, Pep undone by last gasp VAR decision against Spurs is the Sunday Mirror lead. The Mail on Sunday, capturing the mood quite nicely. Clash of the Decade, very simply. Callan or Reid, Sheedy or Cody, subplots abound as the two dominant sides of the last 10 years square off in Croker. And good pictures to match there on the back page of the Mail. Sunday Times, going with the Premier League yesterday. Picture of Lucas Moura, who scored 16 seconds after coming on as a substitute yesterday. 2-2 between Man City and Spurs. VAR strikes again is the headline. And then over in the right-hand side in the corner, we'll come to this. Richard Dunne, no sense to McCarthy switch. Richard Dunne now talking about the Mick McCarthy 2 years, Stephen Kenny 2 years situation. Back page of the Sunday World then. Boss Cody, doesn't fear tip. The dozen instead of doesn't, because he's going for his 12th All-Ireland title, Brian Cody, this afternoon. The Star then, sweet Jesus. Works pretty well, doesn't it? Man City 2, Spurs 2, VAR holds champs. A picture of Gabriel Jesus yesterday upon realising that the goal had been disallowed. And then finally the Sun. Will Seamus hang the TJ? Pictures of Reid and Seamus Callan ahead of throw-in this afternoon. And beneath that, Man City 2, Spurs 2, VAR gloom. Pep fumes at second video blow. So, gents, thanks for coming in. It's All-Ireland Hurling Final Day. I think, Vincent, we've spoken a few times in the past. This is your number one day of the year?
Yeah, this and Munster Hurling Final Day, I suppose, Joe. I just love them. I love the electricity in the air. And, you know, you're looking at this rivalry, and we should be getting kind of some kind of fatigue in terms of Kilkenny tip, maybe, logically. The extraordinary thing is, if you include the 2014 replay, most of these senior Tipperary players are now going into their 7th All-Ireland Hurling Final, and it's always been Kilkenny at the far side. And yet you can, it's very hard to pick out a poor game in all of those. Maybe the 2012 semi-final when we had this bizarre thing of Larry running after Tommy Walsh. But otherwise, they have largely been magnificent games of hurling. Mm. And it just doesn't get old.
Like that, even some of the league games they have produced. Yeah. If you remember the 2009 league final.
Wow.
In Thurlaston, went to extra time. And then they played two league finals in 2013 and 2014. One was in Nolan Park, again, fractious. And the 2014 game also went to extra time. And it was a really cracking game. I remember being down in Nolan Park one February when Seamus Callan and Colin Fenley both scored hat-tricks. It was just an amazing game. They scored 5 goals each on a February, cold February Sunday afternoon.
Mm.
And some of their games under lights in Semple Stadium in February and March have been cracking games too. So, and probably what probably topped it all, okay, the All-Ireland Final in 2009 and the 2014 drawn game was a you know, high-scoring. But if you go back to the 2013 occasion in 2013 in Nolan Park, that maybe tops everything in terms of atmosphere, and it was just a different setting for it and a different feel to it, and that maybe tops everything, maybe not in game terms, but just occasion wise it wasn't an All-Ireland final, it was a qualifier. So their capacity to thrill is greater than anyone. I think for the neutral, I don't think they ever get tired of it. That's my sense of it. That even in places where hurling isn't the main game, Tipperary and Kilkenny is such a big draw.
It is such an elemental feel to it when they play. And you know, it's funny that the cliche we've been hearing all week is if it becomes a war, there's only one winner. But if you actually look at it, Colin was referring to that 09 league final. I've never seen a more furiously contested game, but it came about 5 weeks after Tip had been beaten by 17 points in Nolan Park. And actually, there was a five-week period in that league where they were just running amok against teams. Mm. They were hammering everyone, and it ended with a 24-point defeat of Cork in Nolan Park. And this was coming on the back of, was it 23 points to beat Waterford in the previous year's All-Ireland final. It looked like they were really separating themselves from the rest of the game. Mm. And that was when Liam Sheedy's Tipperary stood up for themselves in this epic league final. It went to extra time. Kilkenny won. But Jackie Tyrrell, in his book, refers to it as Tip kind of winning psychologically. Because I think, as he puts it, they looked into our eyes and they didn't see anything supernatural.
Mm.
And that was the moment. And this is why I'm kind of slightly tickled by this cliche that, well, if it becomes a war, only one winner. Tip are the one team that have fronted up. These guys have fronted up to Kilkenny over the years, and I think they'll front up today. I've no doubt that the middle third is going to be a war zone.
Mm.
But I've no doubt that Tip, you look at their half-back line, are you telling me they're not going to front up? Yes, they are.
Yeah, my only doubts about Tipperary were stem from that Munster hurling final, when I thought Limerick brought a rage and a level of physical aggression that day that I felt Tipperary weren't able to go with. And I thought Kyle Hayes probably identified most in that regard, that, you know, he put Pádraig Maher on the back foot, and that Tipperary half-back line was put on the back foot like I haven't seen since Kilkenny were in their prime. So that would be my concern for Tipperary in that regard. And yes, they have fronted up, and certainly that 2009 league final in Thurles was the first occasion when we really saw it. Because Kilkenny, as you say, had come off that back of that year of imperious dominance that almost has the feel to where Dublin are now.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I felt about it when you thought, are they going to lose?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Tip came in, hit them so hard in the first few minutes. That was when the yellow card
in that league final,
was sent off.
So there were Martin Cumberford lasted 16 seconds or something.
Yeah. So there was all of this going into in the maelstrom. And in the end, Kilkenny did get the job. And Richie Hogan was actually just coming on the scene at that stage. Richie Hogan was just on the scene. Kilkenny got the job done. But that was the first seeds of doubt.
But the elemental nature of it, if you go back to that league final, I think Brian Hogan had his collarbone broken in a challenge after a few minutes of that league final. And then, was it Seamus Callanan got hit by Jackie Tyrrell very early in the All-Ireland final?
The All-Ireland final.
And it was payback time.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of, that was the personality of the fixture. It just took off from there.
I would think that the, and just from recall, the first 20 minutes of the 2009 and 2010 All-Ireland finals were like nothing I think I had ever seen before in a hurling match, and rarely since. And there's been some absolutely brilliant games, and even the first 15 minutes of the last All-Ireland semi-final when Kilkenny beat Limerick 3 weeks ago, that had it too. But just that the atmosphere and the level of confrontation that those two teams produced on those 2 days. Now, obviously, with Henry's injury in the 2010 game, that drifted away from Kilkenny that day. But I just remember the ferocity of the exchanges in the first 20 minutes of both those games were like nothing.
We've name-checked a few finals there, and Colm, you mentioned 2014, so we'll use that as the point where we'll jump off, because it reminded me of something Henry Shefflin said on page 3 of the Sunday Times here in his piece. And he says a more interesting thing at the outset, which we'll come to in a second, with a great Cody anecdote from recent times. But you mentioned 2014 as being this brilliant match. So he talks, Shefflin here, about how Tip's forward play is designed to drag defenders around the place. Kilkenny weren't able to cope with that in 2014. He said, I can remember Cody being absolutely livid after the 2014 draw. Massively high scoring game, brilliant to watch for all the neutrals. But all he could think about were the tackles that weren't being made, the intensity that was missing. He hated the openness. That is Shefflin's memory of 2014, very different from all the neutrals.
I remember being out in the City West Hotel on the Sunday morning after the replay and sitting down with Cody in one of his great 10 or 15 minute interviews before he went off to Crumlin with the Cup, and that's the day he excoriated Barry Kelly too. But one of the things he mentioned was he didn't think the replay. We all thought, this is this the greatest game of all time?
Mm.
Brian Cody said, It might be for ye or it might be for someone else, but certainly for me it wasn't, because the hooking, the blocking, the tackling, it wasn't that war zone. He says, I think, and obviously I'm biased, but I think that the replay was a much better game. To me, it was far better. And there's a passage of play in that 2014 replay where, and Jackie Tyrrell references it as probably his favourite passage of play that he's ever been involved with. And the number of times that Tipperary players are repelled, and I think it ends up with a John Power point at the Hill 16 end, and it just, it said everything about Kilkenny of that era. If you were to take a snapshot of Kilkenny, a passage of play, and say, there they are, that was probably it, the way they repelled three or four different Tipperary players, and it helped to break the game that day. But yes, that wasn't, the drawn game wasn't Brian Cody's type of game.
No interest in that. Shefflin tells an anecdote at the start of his piece, which is great, and kind of captures where Cody is even in 2019.
Yeah, so Henry recalls Ballyhale and Kilkenny training at the same venue in the run-up to the All-Ireland Club Final, and Brian Cody comes over to wish him well in Ballyhale's final, and also to tell him that he expected the Ballyhale players, TJ Reid, Adrian Mullen, Joey Holden and Colin Fenley and a number of others, to be in training on the following Wednesday. And Henry thought, he didn't think it was fair, but he also understood that was Cody, and he says, was it tough on them? He writes, it's supposed to be tough. And I suppose that sums up Brian Cody in many ways. The final is over, club final, just get on with it. No time to breathe. Henry thought maybe they should get a week. Maybe they should get a little bit more time. Yeah. He wasn't having any of it.
Because he says, my first reaction was it was unfair and the lads win or lose, they were going to let their hair down for a couple of days. Kilkenny's league campaign was over. The championship was still 2 months away. Would it have killed Cody to give them a week off?
What I find interesting here is that one of the greatest hurlers we've ever seen wouldn't dream of saying to Brian, that's unfair, you know.
I'd say this is the first Cody knew.
Exactly, you're reading Henry's column and you're knowing he said that to himself.
Yeah.
But that the boys will have been in on Wednesday for training. And it's a measure of the force of Cody's personality. And even when I was doing Henry's book, when Henry's career was tapering out in 2014, there was no big, warm friendship there. And Henry would tell you that he had what he considered a unique relationship with management over his years in the team, where on the Tuesday in Kilkenny, when they were celebrating in All-Ireland, and the players would obviously meet in one pub, but the management team, Cody and his selectors, would invariably meet somewhere else. And Henry would dip between the two. The only player who dipped between the two, because he had that kind of, you know,
stature
with them, and he felt that that gave him a special place. But when it came to 2014, he didn't have a special place.
Right. It's temporary.
Maybe the other thing that exchange says is that Brian Cody has been feeling more heat and more pressure than he needs. He knew how much he needed TJ Reid back as quick as possible.
It's a good point, because Shefflin does say, in fairness, results had been patchy. He was still trying to build a team. Like, we look at it from this vantage point and all is well. But at that stage, he wanted the lads back in the headspace as soon as possible. He says, Shefflin, this run to the final has been all about Cody. Nobody could have imagined it during the Leinster Championship. And then he goes through the All-Ireland Final routine generally. He said, the players would have been told the team on Friday night, and that's when Cody will have made his big team talk. In the 16 years I spent in Nolan Park, the message didn't change from year to year. But he says, in those situations, he's an incredible communicator. His presence dominates the room. Even if you've heard him say these things a million times, you're still hanging on every word.
I remember being at the coaching conference in Croke Park one year, and you're looking to see, well, is there anything different that Brian Cody says in public that he's saying to an audience like that? And you don't get the sense that there is. But he on that day, unscripted, he spoke for 40 minutes, and he spoke about the sanctity of the dressing room and the importance of it, and how Nolan Park was their centre of excellence.
Yeah.
And it was very fundamental stuff, but his delivery was magnificent. I just found, you've heard it before, you've heard the words of genuineness and honesty, and he uses these words over and over again, but it's delivery, and he held the room that day without a script, without a PowerPoint presentation, nothing. He had no props, he just spoke with his arms over the podium, and he delivered it brilliantly, and everybody came away that day feeling that they really got something out of it. So you can just probably transplant yourself in there, and if you can catch his voice, you can just you can just get the sense of the firmness and his conviction in what he's saying. And he believes it, and he believed it about this team, because on the morning after the 2016 defeat, he said, there are players in Kilkenny, and they're going to come, and they're going to come quickly, and I can assure you of that. And a lot of people would have doubted that, and I probably would have doubted. You might have doubted, maybe, is it gone for them? Where's the underage success?
And let's be honest,
and yet here they are.
There were even whispers last year, has the game passed Cody by?
Yeah.
In the last couple of years.
Well, there were whispers this year. After the league final, after the Leinster final, we did a live podcast down in Hotel Kilkenny.
Right.
And one of the questions I was asked from the floor, this is prior to the All-Ireland quarter-final against Cork, is it time for Cody to go?
Mm.
Now, this is a team, this is a group, they won the league last year with a patched-up team. When Richie Hogan got the goal against Limerick and Thurles in the All-Ireland quarter-final, you're thinking, my God, they're going to make the last four with this hopelessly patched-up team.
Mm.
And yet, after all he's achieved, nobody really in Kilkenny was confident they could beat Cork. But I think the force of the man's personality, if they win today, it's going nuclear. Because how do you quantify what this man is doing?
Well, Shefflin, the byline of his piece is, if Kilkenny pull this off, it will be one of Brian Cody's greatest achievements.
Yeah.
What surpasses it if he wins today?
Nothing. This is it.
This
surpasses everything. You could argue that already, by getting them to the final, it's right up there with anything that he's achieved, because he has had that stellar cast, and he's had that stellar cast throughout the 2000s and even into the earlier part of this decade, when Michael Fenley and TJ Reid and Richie Hogan and Paul Murphy was in his prime as a defender for those few years.
Mm.
But to be able to pull this around, we'll say even from that early exit against Waterford in 2017, and again it went to extra time, it probably had no business going to extra time, that was their earliest exit in his time in July in 2017, and yet they were able to bring that Waterford team to extra time, who reached an All-Ireland final subsequently. They almost took Limerick down last year. So even though we think they've been holed under for a while, they're actually biting at the main protagonists in that year, in Waterford and Limerick. So I would put this ahead of any achievement. We would have thought even last year's league, to win the league from the position that they won it from last year, was right up there with anything they achieved. And I always remember the crowd coming out, being ecstatic in Nolan Park after winning a league. And you'd say, would it even register in the past that they'd win a league in Thurles? But that day the crowd spilled out, and it really meant something. And I think the way they took out Limerick the last day has really, really endeared them to certainly back into the Kilkenny public, and has also elevated Brian Cody's legend, if you want, that how could a performance like that be produced against All-Ireland champions, league champions, Munster champions, such convincing Munster and league champions on both final days, and yet they bring this manic passage of play in the first 15 minutes that knocks Limerick back so much and leaves them playing catch up.
You have to bear in mind, excuse me, that this day, 13 years ago, Brian Cody was berating the media after they beat Cork to stop Cork's 3-in-a-row bid as, you're going to have to change your tune, basically. And he was defending Noel Hickey, everyone saying Noel Hickey was too slow. Well, he didn't look too slow to me.
Mm.
That's 13 years ago. He's been fighting this fight of proving people wrong over and over and over again. But what's really borderline miraculous about this is only 8 players have started every championship game this year. Only 8. That's basically half the team. He's been chopping and changing, looking for solutions here, looking for solutions there. I think the semi-final against Limerick may well be his greatest achievement.
Yeah.
Because, as Colm says, what Limerick did to Tip in the Munster final, they won by 12 points. If it wasn't for Brian Hogan, they could have won by 24. Mm. They just dominated Tipperary physically. Now, I think Tip will look back on that week and feel they got their training load slightly wrong, but that still doesn't cover that gap.
Yes.
But to do to Limerick, and I'm sure Limerick are asking themselves questions about this first 14 minutes where they're 1-8 to 2 points down. They were just like rabbits caught in the headlights. Just his spatial understanding, and this is what he doesn't get enough credit for. People talk about ferocity and genuineness, these words.
I had to look up genuineness a couple of years ago to check was it actually a word. Yeah,
it is such a word.
And it made sense. It's like there's no way he would use that word so often if it wasn't a real word, but he's the only person I've ever heard use it. So
it
I looked it up.
Absolutely his word.
100%.
It is a
a word, though. No, but it's also in the dictionary.
I didn't know.
So rest assured, because no one would have had the temerity to go, Brian, I'm not sure that's a word.
Good luck with that.
You mentioned Noel Hickey is too slow after 2006. He said the same thing about JJ Delaney in 2014 in the post-match press conference, and he's able to look us in the eye and say, well, I don't know who said JJ Delaney was too slow, but it just became a thing for him. Yeah. Someone said it. Oh, you all said that JJ Delaney was too slow because he had trouble with Seamus Callaghan. Seamus Callaghan had scored 7 points in the drawn game. Now, Seamus Callaghan still played very well in the replay, but there was that famous hook by JJ to stop him from scoring a third, which is one of the great moments in those catalogue of games too. But you mentioned eight players, Vincent. Eight players have started all the games. If you look back at how he has gone so far to build a team in the last 3 years, he has given championship debuts to 22 players in 3 years. Last season alone, I think there was 10. The others have been between 2017. Now, if you think of the settled nature of the team between 2006 and, say, right up to 2012, I'd say there's probably half that number of debutants. So he's really trawled, he's really thrown the net far and wide. And I think even tactically, he has made adjustments. I mean,
absolutely.
But he's always put out the vibe that tactics are nothing.
I think that ties in with your point on his spatial awareness. I think he probably just sees so much and almost doesn't give himself credit for how much he's actually taken in, and how in an instant I'd say he knows what certain matchups will work and why they'll work without even being able to fully explain why. You know, and because Sheedy, Shane McGrath was on during the week and he was saying, well, you know, Sheedy wouldn't position himself as the biggest hurling brain in the room, but he's a brilliant delegator. Whereas Tommy Walsh was on as well and he was saying, no, Cody, he's still like seeing stuff that, you know, not everybody is seeing. And he'd probably, you know, if you said to Cody, but that is tactics, he'd probably say, it's not tactics, it's just hurling.
Just pull the half-back line pull the midfield back, you know.
I think some of his greatest work is the way he has shaken up teams between the All-Ireland final replays that he's involved in. If you think of him springing Walter Walsh,
the adjustment he made between the draw and the replay in 2014, it was a completely different game.
Yeah.
So Kieran Joyce comes in on Bonner Maher,
man of the match.
Porrick Walsh comes in. Yeah. Brian Hogan is dropped. Things that you'd say, no, that can't happen, and they happen.
Yeah.
And they work, and they win. And Cody is left saying, well, you all said the game changed when player went and won, but here we are, hurling doesn't change. But in fact, he does change. And I think even Killian Buckley's selection today says something, that Killian Buckley will probably play a more defensive role because they are conscious of what maybe Seamus Callaghan can do to that full-back line.
To round off the Shefflin piece then, and we'll move on because there are loads of great pieces. He says, who wins? I think Kenny will squeeze the life from Tip. Is his point. If Kilcody pull it off, it'll be one of Cody's greatest achievements without question. We'll get on to other predictions in a moment. To round back one last point before I go to an ad break, you were talking there about how, you know, Shefflin had the stature to go between both groups, players and management, and then ultimately when his end arrives, he's cut off as ruthlessly as everyone else. Like Jackie Tyrrell said something similar about meeting Cody for his retirement chat. And Michael Verney had a great piece with David Herity on Friday. And he met Cody as well at the end, and he said the nicest thing Cody said to him was, you had a great run of things.
A good run, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Do you think Shefflin was hurt by that?
I think he was hurt at the time. I think he was a bit confused by it because he felt he had a line of communication to Brian that didn't prove to be the case when his career was tapering. But if the way Henry describes some of the weekends they had in Carton House, there was an absolute coldness. They'd call the players in and the management would be at a table and how do you feel you're playing? And it was very much a kind of, you're on that side of the table, we're on this side of the table, and no player gets any special treatment here. And Henry's description of it is very cold. It's a very cold environment. It's a very hard environment. But Cody has always had this thing. It's self-sufficiency, it's personal responsibility. You stand up and you be a man. And when we talk about that spatial understanding, and I think he's a wizard with spatial understanding, but he also expects his players to understand it. And you see enough, I think Tommy has spoken about this, you see an awful lot of players taking control out there. And that seemed to happen in the quarterfinal against Cork, where the half-back line was too far out from the full-back line. And there was a huge gap there, and you have the likes of Patrick Horgan and Alan Cadigan inside, absolutely causing chaos. And in those first 7 or 8 minutes, you thought, Cork are going to destroy them here. Mm. But the adjustment was made by the players, and he demands that. But I think it's through this kind of hard love, you know, that they... I was writing about this during the week, that they are so desperate to get a kind word from him that they will go to war, and for him to say, "Well done, Henry." My God, they're levitating, you know.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a short break. We're back with more from Colm Keyes and Vincent Hogan.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Yeah, and you're welcome back. So more on the papers from Colm Keyes and Vincent Hogan, both of the Irish Independent. Lots of analysis, lots of matchups, lots of predictions, as you might imagine, in the papers today. But also some really, really good features, two of which are in the Mail. Sorry, one of which in the Mail that we're going to come to. Really, it's Michael Deignan writing about himself. He's obviously a regular columnist in the Mail on Sunday, writes about hurling all year. And on page 82 and 83... he writes an incredibly personal piece. It is a scary thought for, I mean, I've really started to feel this in latter years, but that the Offaly team of 94, that bunch sort of feel forever young. They'll be the old men in their suits to lots of people looking on today, the Jubilee team. So Michael Deignan is talking about what All-Ireland final day means to him. And he goes from his youth right the way through to current day, Vincent, and it's incredibly personal.
It's a beautiful piece, and it's a lovely piece to write on the day that we'll see the Offaly lads out on the pitch as a Jubilee team. And it always makes me feel really old when I see these guys, because to me they're young guys. You know, I would have been very friendly with the Tip team of 91, and you know, they were out there 3 years ago, obviously, and a lot of them, like myself, going very grey and some losing the hair, and but all wearing these suits that make them look older maybe than they really should look. But yeah, this is a really deeply personal piece, because there's a symmetry to this in the sense that the 2009 final was when his wife Adele was admitted to hospital. Now, she'd been diagnosed with breast cancer much earlier than that, but things came to a head very, very quickly. Mm. They brought her into hospital the morning of the 2009 final between Tip and Kilkenny. She died the following Tuesday week. Mm. Now, Adele was 41, and, you know, leaving behind two young boys and just the impact on their lives, and just I can't imagine what that's like. Mm. That you lose someone so young and the mother of your children. But he writes really, really beautifully about it here, and just trying to cope with this, but also the importance of friendship and the friendships that he's made with those guys. They still keep in touch. They're going on a holiday. The 94 team are going on a holiday to Portugal, I think. But I don't know if you were watching the game, the documentary on RTE during the week, a beautiful documentary, but Dahi Regan is one of those interviewed in it, and he breaks down about the emotion of these days. And, you know, when rotten things happen you, the friendships of a dressing room can sometimes be the thing that pulls you through. And it's so standout to me. Like, he mentions playing golf in Burr there a few weeks ago, and he could hear Johnny Pilkington's abuse from three fairways away. And just... that group have such a story to tell.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were the most unorthodox, unconventional group, I think, that ever won in All-Ireland. And 94, of course, we all remember it as the six-minute final. And what I particularly remember about that day is the access we had as journalists to those players. Mm. Within 2 minutes of those poor Limerick players going into the dressing room, we were in there standing on their towels. Like, you know, it was an extraordinary time, and your so, tape recorder's out.
What happened?
How do you feel about that, you know? So it just feels like a very different time.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a lovely piece by Michael.
Mm. Even if you recall that the 98 Leinster final, and when Babs came out and was over under the Cusick stand side, and he came out and he delivered his tirade against the Offaly players and sheep in a heap, and
blamed,
all of these.
He blamed
things.
Me.
Yes.
And there was about 14 minutes around there, but he only read The Independent.
And 11 weeks later, they were All-Ireland champions from that, with a new manager who walked into a dressing room on the following Friday, and none of them really knew who they were. They suspected who he was. So it is, and Michael captures everything there and aligns it obviously with his own personal story. He captures it very well. One of the striking things about it was, and I'd forgotten this, is he was actually an analyst with RTE while he was still a player, which would be very, very unusual now. Obviously there's guest spots when they're out of the championship, but he was in the middle of it, and he was analysing games and climbing up to the old commentary box, and he references that above the Nally stand.
Yeah.
They go up on the ladder and in. It only seems like yesterday, but I mean it probably is. It's just changed so much, even in the last 15 or 20 years.
I mean, he talks about the mystique of Offaly because they win the hurling championship in 81 and then obviously do what they do in 82 in the football, and there was a mystique about it. 25 years ago, he remembers it in some ways as the Dooleys All-Ireland, because Joe, Billy and Johnny got 2-11 between the three of them, quite remarkable, he says. And then of Pilkington, he showed his nerve in his decision to go for goal when he was told to put it over the bar by our manager, Eamon Cregan. Johnny looked over it and Eamon pointed up and Johnny thought, no, that's not going to do it. And I thought that captures the kind of madness, the brilliant madness, and the they knew their own mind, that team.
They very much knew their own mind, and Johnny Dooley nailing that was a huge moment, because I think Pat O'Connor got a goal. It was Johnny Dooley nailed it, and again, as Michael says, Eamon Cregan's direction was put it over the bar, but this guy, no, that's not going to be enough.
I think 8 out of 10 today put it over the bar, if not 9.
Absolutely,
out of 10.
Absolutely, but suddenly the momentum, it was like a bomb going off at that end of the field, where suddenly Pat O'Connor scores a goal, a 6-point swing in 30 seconds basically, and just, it was devastating for Limerick. But in those last 4 or 5 minutes, Billy Dooley started scoring for fun at the Hill end as well, and it all just turned. But I can't remember in hurling a more intriguing group of people than that Offaly team. Like, you had someone like Brian Whelan, I think he was on the team of the Millennium, he was one of the greatest hurlers you'd ever see. But then you had the Johnny Pilkingtons, this great, phenomenal character who revelled in this idea that he was out drinking pints every night smoking 40 silk cut every night. But it's clear as day, the one thing Johnny Pilkington had, he had a phenomenal engine, and he could go and go and go. But he played up to the caricature, if you like.
And if you talk to Doughty or to Michael Deignan, they feel it does him and almost them a disservice.
Absolutely, like
they think Pilkington doesn't get the credit. He never missed a training session.
Wonderful, skillful hurler. I mean, he had risked to die for as a hurler. Yeah. He really, and his striking of the ball, everything about him, it's just that sometimes he would switch off himself, but when he went for it and applied, and he knew coming up to a big game, he was able to deliver all the time.
And they were open with the media, like, you know, they liked it. Michael's so open here, it's just an incredible, you read it and you think, my God, this is, you take a few seconds afterwards and it stays with you, because he talks in depth about, you know, Adele, 02 breast cancer, then terminal diagnosis in 06, and it's 09 when she goes into hospital with pneumonia around the day of the All-Ireland, and he talks about going to visit her that evening and everything's okay, and then she dies the following Tuesday, September 09, and he says, even though now the date has changed somewhat, that All-Ireland hurling final day for him is always inextricably linked to Adele, and so that's what he's kind of going through.
And do you know what I think is lovely? He references Pat McLaughlin, one of the selectors who has passed as well, but he has a line here, I suppose there are only two of the group that aren't with us, and it's very much saying that the wives and girlfriends were part of that group, that the personalities of those players, they weren't isolated personalities, they came from people around them, and obviously Michael's personality hugely shaped by Adele, but the idea that those two people will be remembered today, that Pat McLaughlin and of course Adele, will be very much in their minds when they go out in that field.
Yeah.
And a unique team, really, and a unique era for Offaly, given where they find themselves now. I think the context of that, and to think only 25 years ago, and even only 21 years ago, that they were all Ireland champions, and to see where they are now, I suppose sets a context for today too.
Yeah, it does. And for people who read Michael's book a couple of years ago, where he talked about all this, he mentions that his eldest son is in his last year down in Limerick, and
another,
his other son
is
going to DCU in September. They're doing very well, and I think as well it really should be commended for, it talks about a few years ago he met Aisling Fennan, brother of Tadhg, Kildare footballer, and he said she's been a huge part of our lives this last number of years. He said, you're trying to move on, you've different feelings about life, about meeting someone else and the lads and the guilt about moving on, but Aisling has been a big part of our lives. Again, you know, he's touching on heavy, deep, personal stuff here that's hard to talk about publicly.
Yeah, I mean, I would know Aisling, you know, I knew she was Tadhg's sister and that, but I suppose you feel it's very hard to talk about a new partner in that
very
situation,
hard, yeah.
Because you don't want this sense of guilt that you're kind of almost erasing the other people, which obviously the whole point of this is that he's doing the opposite.
Yes,
he's talking about Adele and he's talking with great love about Adele, but he's also mentioning the importance that Aisling has been to the two boys, and I know that Michael is hugely involved with the two boys. They're both hurlers, and this is the beauty of the game, I suppose. Everything keeps turning over and turning over. Mm. Your children follow your path, and both Michael's sons are following his path. But Aisling has been a big part of their lives, and clearly is well loved by the kids.
Yeah. Well, it was a great piece, 82 and 83 pages of the Mail on Sunday, because it could be very easy to come out and write who's going to win the match today.
Yeah, exactly.
He didn't do that at all. Joe Hayes in the Sunday Times is another feature which you both want to mention. Page 4. So tell us about Joe Hayes, younger listeners.
Yeah, look, Joe Hayes, the Tipperary team that broke through under Babs in 87, when Richie Stakelin famously announced in Killarney that the famine was over. Tip hadn't won a Munster final since 71. And so 16 years on, this group that broke through under Babs, Joe Hayes wouldn't have been one of the big superstar players of that group, like the Pat Foxes or the Nicky Englishes, right. But he would have been one of the big personalities of that group. And the whole dynamic of that dressing room, there was a lot of the lightness came from Joe Hayes, who was a bit of a warrior as well, but the fun. I remember going for barbecues out in Nicky's house when he was living out in Fox Rock, and all the Bonners would be there. But Joe would do his stand-up routines. And Joe was one of the first people I've ever heard mimic Micheál Ó Muirchertach,
right.
You know, and he was very, very good at it.
Right.
But he'd do a commentary about his own performance. And he was priceless. But there's this famous story told about Joe. One day they were Tipper down in Nolan Park playing Kilkenny and getting absolutely hosed. And Babs was livid with them in the dressing room at halftime. And he went around jabbing people in the stomach, you know, and his punchline before they went out was, "Who's going to win this match? Who's going to win this?" And he comes to Joe, "Who's going to win this match?" "Geez, my money would be on Kilkenny, Babs." And even Babs had to break down laughing. But that was Joe. But
right.
The thing is, those of us who've known Joe, and I've known Joe for 40 years now, there's a second part to his personality. And he was the life and soul of the party, but we also knew there was a dark side. Mm-hmm. And that there was, I suppose, what this piece tells me, Joe, is we're much more adult nowadays in how we discuss mental health. And thank God for that. Mm. And it's lovely that Joe has been open enough to discuss this with Dennis Walsh.
Would this be the first time really he's talked about it?
Well, it's the first time I've seen it.
Okay.
And I like would have been one of those who knew it. But I didn't know that he had been admitted to James's Hospital on Christmas Day in 93. So I didn't know the specifics of it. I knew there was a lot going on there. And, you know, as he says himself, I got mixed up in prescribed medication, became addicted to it. It was a very, very hard time. The only thing I had, and I remember I brought it in, I had a hurley with me. I remember hitting a ball up against a wall, but I had no interest in it.
Mm.
You think of hurling at the time.
That was 93.
1993, and this macho game. And, you know, if you were suffering any kind of depression, the reflex of people around you was probably catch yourself on, you know, come on, drive on here, we need you.
Right.
Babs Keating comes out of this with great credit, that Babs went in and visited him in Pats and made it very clear to him, you are part of our plans, Joe. And over the years, there was a wonderful chemistry between Joe and Babs, because Joe spent most of his time probably as a sub, coming in as an impact sub. He tells you he made a huge difference in different games here, which he did, actually. He was a very good player.
Mm.
But that was a very, very good Tipperary team.
He says, I never forgot Babs doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I go back to is 1993, I'm not sure a lot of hurling managers would have done that.
Really?
No, I think it was a much more strict kind of old school toughen up type of mentality, you know, not just in hurling, but particularly in hurling, which is this fundamentally manly game.
Well, even in 2019, where we're supposed to be increasingly gender neutral, it's still one of the few sports I find on the show where the pundits will, and we even did it at the top, I noticed, and I always feel increasingly how queasy do you get about this, I don't know, but it's where the phrase manliness is used liberally. Like, who's going to go out and be manly today? Mm. It's still part of the ethos and the culture. So in 93, I can very much imagine it was like the foundation.
Yeah, and Babs would have had this very blunt core to him, and he fell out with a lot of players when he came back as a manager of his second coming, where he was just so blunt, and he'd say things, and he'd say things quite brutally to your face. But there's a kindness in how he dealt with Joe, and that's really lovely to see that it's so long ago that Babs had the wherewithal to see that this guy needed help.
To go and see him. Yeah.
One of the striking things for me in reading this piece is his journey after hurling, where he was a guard, and he went up to Emmyvale on the border and became immersed in hurling up there, and won a title with Monaghan, but then suggested that the Monaghan County Board weren't interested in promoting hurling, and he trained camogie teams. But after that, and I wasn't actually aware of this, and Joe would crop up from time to time, around big games, and obviously you'd hear stories about him, but I didn't realise he was out in Portugal. And then I had heard he was back in London and up in Liverpool for a while as well. So he really has got around the place. He's got around, and now he's back in Tipperary. But he really has had some journey since his playing days ended.
If you're listening and you're wondering about the Portugal reference, he 25 years retired as a guard, left Monaghan to come to Portugal. He says, "It was more therapeutic than anything that I went out there. The sun shining, it's nice. I got friendly with a fellow who had a bar. I lived in an apartment at the rear of his house. He had a great swimming pool. Living like a king. I was doing a bit of gardening and landscaping, not too much now. I was working the head more than anything else. It was a beautiful life, but I got bored with it, and then London and Liverpool, and now he's back in Ireland for a while." So working the head is clearly a lifelong thing to be worked.
Quintessential Joe is where he talks about 6 years ago, his club, Clonalty Rossmore, organised a white-collar boxing event to generate funds.
Yeah.
Hayes was top of the bill. Stitched on his robe was the White Tiger of Sevilla. His opponent was the Beast of Dundrum, Paddy Slattery. Joe is quoted thus: "You often heard of corruption in boxing. I won, but I didn't get the verdict. They gave it a draw. I put him down twice. It's on YouTube, you can watch it. I decked your man twice. The man was full of muscle, and I've ne'er a muscle. I'd say there was a lot of illegal betting patterns, but there was no investigation."
I think we put it on YouTube on the way over in the car to Croke Park afterwards.
Yeah. But I remember Niall Quinn telling me, when he was in charge of the Monaghan, I think it was with the camogie team, and he asked Niall to say a few words. And Joe arrived over to Niall to tape Niall's few words for the women. And as Niall describes it, he looked in the back and he had this tape recorder which was the size of a suitcase. But that was Joe. He has this brilliant personality, but he's in, just reading this, he seems to be in a good place.
I guess you have to be someone to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
A level of self-knowledge to get to that point where you can talk about it. Dennis, by the way, if you're done with the humour as well, self-glorification was part of his comic routine. "Who do you think is the best player in Ireland?" he once asked Michael Lester. "And why am I?"
That's typical Joe.
We're talking about a player from 25, 35 years ago on the morning of an All-Ireland final.
Good piece, though.
It's lovely. And we've just spoken about the 94 from 25 years ago. I don't think there probably are Joe Hayes and Johnny Pilkington figures out there at the moment, but the level of expression hides them away. And I know it's a point that we repeat time and time again, but this just crystallizes it again.
Maybe in 10 years you get them. Maybe, in 15,
maybe
20
will.
Years, they sit down, they're free, they're more open, you get great stories.
Well, I think that's what we're seeing, Joe, that the more interesting pieces are coming from former players, that there's such a sanitized environment for the current players.
There was a piece earlier in the summer with George O'Connor, and similarly,
Dennis did that as well.
The value of these pieces, you can't overlook them.
It's kind of the joy of All-Ireland hurling final day, though. Like, the days are all linked. Any bit of nostalgia is welcome on the day of All-Ireland final day. It's the lovely thing. Everyone remembers different things. Like, he finishes, actually, it's a brilliant point that he makes at the end, Joe Hayes, by saying, "The head is fine now. I enjoy going to matches and playing. All my friends are getting old, and there's people getting sick, and there are people dying that we know. It would make you realise, hey, it's Sunday, it's All-Ireland final day. We're going down Jones's Road. Breathe it in."
It's lovely, lovely quote.
Beautiful.
Lovely quote,
James O'Connor, by the way, just to revert to the analysis for a second, you were saying he's not muddled in his thinking, but he contradicts himself.
He's broken it down. He's broken it down in the Sunday Independent into four different parts. So he has the Kilkenny defence versus the Tipperary attack, and obviously that goes back to 2016. and to Tipperary full forward that line. The Tipperary full forward line that day, 2:15 they scored from play.
Yeah.
So that's a big factor. Two of them are still involved. So he
that was
breaks.
Cody's worst hour, by the way.
It was.
That he let that situation continue for so long.
Yeah, that a player would score 9 points from play.
Yeah.
And there was so much exposure. And obviously he said, you know, the players involved who are marking shouldn't be that would be lazy analysis. They shouldn't be pinned for it. Mm. The pressure should have been applied from over here. But Jamesy breaks down four different sections. Kilkenny defence versus Tipperary attack. Advantage Tipperary. Midfield, the advantage is Kilkenny's. Kilkenny attack versus Tipperary defence, that's a stalemate. Okay. So it's one all.
Right.
And the clincher is goalkeepers, puck out strategies, advantage Kilkenny. But when it comes to the verdict, like the rest of us, a lot of the rest of us, there are very, very few who have opted for Kilkenny.
Mm.
He's going for a Tipperary win.
Mm.
So despite coming down in favour in the breakdown in four different sections with Kilkenny, the overall package says Tipperary. And that's probably reflected through all the verdicts in all the papers. If we go through them all, most are leaning towards a Tipperary win without any real conviction. And I think that's probably the way everyone is thinking of this game, is that there's just an edginess because it's Kilkenny, because of what they did to the All-Ireland champions in the first 20 minutes or 15 minutes of that game the last day. But maybe Tip's experience and maybe 2016 still resonates deeply.
Okay, that's the hurling. We're not going to get through everything else, and it's kind of been an All-Ireland hurling final day special here in the papers. But a few bits and pieces. David Goff appears here and there. Shane McGrath and Mick Foley both give it different treatments. They both see it in different ways. Shane McGrath is making the argument, shouldn't we just have a rule next year whereby let's just take the issue out of it of living and working in the same place as one of the teams, whereas Mick Foley is arguing the other side of the case. I know you came down on Mick Foley's side during the week, Colm.
Yeah. Precedent was already set in 2015 when David Coldrick took the All-Ireland final. Living and working in Dublin a long time at this stage, he refereed that match. There was no real big kickback. Obviously, this focuses on 2016 when David Goff, who lives and works in Dublin too, despite being involved with a club in Meath, no more than David Coldrick, and does all his refereeing in Meath. Mistakes happened that day. There was a 45 that went to Dublin when it clearly shouldn't have, and Dean Rock put it over. And then there was the challenge by Kevin McManaman on Peter Crowley. The line of vision, David Goff came out after and says, my line of vision was blocked by Mick Fitzsimons.
Yeah.
If you look at any video of it and you see Mick Fitzsimons in between his line of vision, he probably didn't get a clear view. It was no doubt a miss. I would think Brian Sheehan probably would have scored the free, given his ability to kick frees at that time. I think he probably would have. Then it was a draw match. It's a different scenario. Those two went against Kerry. And then Goff's background, living and working in Dublin, teacher to a school that has connections with St Jude's, and coming the Munskull involvement and all of that came in. And the GAA backed away from putting him into any Dublin games until the Monaghan League match last year when he was back in. And then he took charge of the Cork game this year. So I think the ice was broken with regard to David Goff. You have to entrust a referee's integrity. I get the perception of bias and that. And if a referee was living in Kerry from Cork, but was living and working in Kerry, well, how would that play out? And I would assume Dublin would be pretty anxious about that too, and how that looks. But David Goff has taken Dublin games since, and they've gone fine. He reversed a penalty decision
in the Cork game,
which took a lot of conviction to do, to go in and consult and say, right, I got it wrong, and overturn it. Again, his view mightn't have been as good as what he would have wanted. Monaghan beat Dublin in the league game. Dublin has a quarter of the population. It has a large population. People move seamlessly and almost without recognition through the city. Obviously, he has an involvement. It is different to living in Kerry, where the concentration is different. It is different for everybody in that. Does it really belong to Dublin? It's everybody's city, really, because it's the capital city.
I actually think the fact that
and Shane himself makes this point, that Eamon Fitzmaurice referenced that 2016 game weakens his case. I mean, you know, is a referee not entitled to make mistakes? I mean, you can make an argument that, okay, they have to recruit referees and improve that side of it. But I felt really uncomfortable listening to the Kerry voices coming out in this during the week. And it struck me that because Eamon said what he said, there was a sense of duty almost of other players coming in behind him and defending it. I just look at David Goff's situation. I'm glad they gave him the final. But imagine the pressure on him now. The pressure on him in that final is going to be ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I just don't think it's fair what they've done to him.
I think on the basis that he's living and working, he's a referee at the top of his craft, okay, over the last number of years. Himself and Conor Lane have probably moved on ahead. Everybody has a different opinion about referees, obviously, and how they interpret things. But generally, David Goff and Conor Lane have been up there, have probably just edged ahead in that pack of elite referees now. And there are a couple coming behind as well that will probably make All-Ireland final status in the next few years. But if you were to preclude David Goff on the basis of residency, and Dublin keep reaching All-Ireland finals, and if Kerry have this objection, if that was to be taken on board by the appointments committee, chances are Dublin and Kerry are going to be in All-Ireland finals for the next 4 to 5 years. It'd be very hard to see, given the way they've been stockpiling the reserves now, it'd be very hard to see them, one or the other, not in them. And if the appointments committee were to say, well, we can't put David Goff in for a Kerry game and we can't put him in for a Dublin game, his career would have passed him by at this stage without ever getting an opportunity to referee an All-Ireland final. I felt they should have put him in to last year's All-Ireland final with Dublin and Tyrone. That was the time I felt to
break the ice,
to break it, and put him in there. Don't think there'd be any arguments about that. He will referee it dispassionately. I'm quite sure of that. And he'd just get on with it and do a good job.
Mm.
And probably last year was the year to do it. They got him in for the quarterfinal against Cork. There was no issue. In fact, on the same podcast where Eamon made his remarks during the week, Ronan McCarthy gave him quite significant backing too. Mm. You know, he's very, very happy. He was a good referee. And no issues with Cork. Obviously, it's a quarter final, it's a lesser game, and they didn't have the history of 2016.
Mm.
But I think Kerry came out pretty quickly, and the chairman showed leadership. I have to credit him for that. Tim Murphy showed leadership. He came out on Thursday morning and said, we're happy.
Yeah.
And they had to say that. Move on.
Because I do understand the theoretical instinct to say, well, let's just, to be very clean about it, let's not have somebody living and working in the same county ref a final. I understand that initial take, but then when you look at the specifics of the demographics of the country, of Goff's record, then really there was no case.
Mm.
And that was my feeling. Now, I do feel there's huge pressure on him.
Probably treating residency in Dublin different to residency.
100%. I'm not so sure a Cork referee living in Tralee should be refing a Kerry match.
100%. The pressure is even far greater then to deliver, because he cannot go down to his local shop without reference to that. You can in Dublin.
You can. Yeah.
And David Goff certainly can in large parts of Dublin without being recognised. But you're not going to be able to do that so easily.
It begs the question. I mean, I think Kieran Whelan came out with this. Is it a double dose of Q tourism? Did they know he was going to get it and just
clear from a long way out he was going to get it. And that was certainly the vibe. And I think it would have been pretty well known in Kerry, even before the semi-final, that David Goff was right in line to referee this game.
So it's mission accomplished now?
Possibly. I mean, you know, if there's a contentious decision, is he going to be reluctant to give it against Kerry now? You know, I mean, I don't know. I just feel the idea that he's involved with coming to Munskull in Dublin and that, you just can't compare that to a fellow who was maybe living in Listowel or something.
No.
You know,
I'm not so sure it is cute tourism. It may have developed that way, but I think Eamon Fitzmaurice was just contributing to a discussion and gave an honest opinion.
I think so.
He would have an issue, and Kerry would have an issue with David Goff in the 2017 Mayo replay as well, Darren O'Sullivan's black card and some decisions around that too. So obviously there's a thing there. And they've used the residency issue to maybe just cloud it a little bit. I don't think it's, I have to say, I don't think it's a deliberate ploy. I mean,
I don't know.
But it's just developed that way.
I'd say Fitzmaurice still has 2016 on his mind and doesn't feel great about it. But we did a piece on it during the week, and we offered Fitzmaurice the chance to come on. And he said, no, look, I don't want this to look like it's a massive vendetta. You know, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying that. He didn't want to come on and really do it again and make a big deal about it.
I just think it was part of a debate and a discussion. And
I don't think they would have anticipated their podcast chat dominating the national conversation for a few days, and probably on some level feel like, geez, that got a bit out of hand. Because my quirk even came on that night and he said, like, geez, you know, I just checked my phone this afternoon. I can't believe how this has become such a big thing.
But I think it's because it was the former manager. There was going to be misgivings about him because of 2016 and because of who was involved in the contentious decisions and because of the links, and two and two becomes whatever it becomes. But David Goff is a fine referee. I don't think anyone could dispute that. Yeah. And no referee goes out to do anything other than the best job possible.
And I think a few people remarked that maybe being a Meath man should preclude him from reffing Dublin matches. And where does this end? Like, so say David Goff leaves Dublin. What's the statute of limitations on your Dublin bias? Like, how long are you out of the city before you can referee a Dublin match?
Cleansed, is it?
Yeah, before you have that leaning, the niceties of the Dubs is kind of left your system, you know? And sure, like, what if you're married to someone from Dublin? Like, where does it end in a country this small with all this many connections?
Yeah.
Anyway, well, he's getting it. I think everyone just hopes it goes well from now. Jeez, if there's a Seamus Darby
moment.
Yeah, and
I mean, that's the thing we sometimes forget. David Goff has only one ambition from All Ireland Fanta.
Yeah.
He does a great job. And that on the Sunday game, everybody says, you know what, he was marvellous.
I know. That he has been...
only ambition.
Privately reffing under 14 games in Meath so that he could get to a point where he could ruin Kerry. It's not... it was not the master plan here. We'll take a short break. A few other interesting bits and pieces. There's VAR. There's Leo Cullen considering minders for the Leinster rugby team. There's some Rugby World Cup pieces. And Richard Dunn with very interesting things to say about the Mick McCarthy-Stephen Kenny dynamic.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now then, welcome back. Last piece or two, and there's a few good pieces in the Rugby World Cup. Rory Keane remembers that in 1987, the Rose of Tralee was the Irish national anthem. Such were the political issues at the time, which is
this cropped up in Brian O'Driscoll's
documentary.
Shoulder. It struck me watching that, and I thought it was a fantastic documentary. But that really struck me. It was almost the reference is Father Ted. It was almost Monty Python.
But I mean, I was at that World Cup.
Oh, right.
And what people don't realise
is you sing.
I didn't sing.
Did you stand?
But we travelled with the team.
Right.
And the Scottish team. And the Welsh team. And we picked up the Canadian team in Los Angeles. So we had four teams with us on that flight. A big jumbo jet. And then when we got to Auckland, we couldn't land. We were diverted to Christchurch. And we sat on the tarmac in Christchurch for 3 hours. A lot of fellas cracking open their duty-free bottles of whiskey and everything. It was just pandemonium.
That was
the preparation. Like, it was very much a case of that World Cup, the IRFU didn't really want this. The IRFU saw it as a move towards professionalism, which they didn't want.
Yeah.
But it was just, it's bizarre to look back on it. Jeez. And the Rose of Tralee being young.
And did the players sing? Can you remember?
I honestly can't remember, Joe. It was a really howling wind in Wellington that day against Wales. It was one of the worst games of rugby I've ever seen. And it was just, you look back on it and you think, was I really there?
I know.
I remember, actually, New Zealand at the time was a bizarre place because it felt like it was 40 years behind the rest of the world.
Mm.
And I remember being in Dunedin at one stage. I was walking down the street just a million miles away and Jim Glennon appeared at my shoulder. I was looking into this drapery store. And all I could think was, my poor mother would look in here and say, Jesus, what century are they from, you know? And he started laughing because he knew exactly what I was thinking. He says, have you ever been in a place like this?
Right.
But like, it was just, that was one of the most bizarre experiences of my life, that World Cup.
I must dig out the footage. The thought of Frano and Lenehan singing the Rose of Tralee before playing their first World Cup match is just too good. Colin, you wanted to mention before we wrap up Richard Dunn in the Sunday Times, who's an FAI ambassador, interestingly.
He says that in the piece. What jumps over the page here is the doubt he is casting over the succession arrangement of the Irish soccer management that Stephen Kenny will soon be taking over from Mick McCarthy. It could be at the end of the year. It could be next June.
Mm.
But and it's happening, and it's coming fast. And it was probably one of those things last year that says, oh, yeah, that's fine, but that's a long time away now. Mm. And Justice Commons bring it to the fore in some way that this could be happening in the next 3 months.
Yeah.
2 to 3 months.
And Nick said last week if things were to go badly in the qualification campaign, he wouldn't want to be a lame duck. He'd even go before the end of qualification if they were mathematically out of it.
So he barely has his feet under the table.
Yeah.
And yet, this could be happening very soon. And this just ventilates it that little bit more. And he's not in agreement with it. And clearly comes down on the side of, well, this decision shouldn't have been made. He says it's not something that has ever happened before or worked before. To a lot of people, it doesn't make sense. I suppose to the people involved in it, it makes perfect sense. If you have a manager who qualifies and does really well, and then you decide to swap him off, it's crazy. But it is what it is set up now. So, clearly, I don't remember anything like that. Actually, Michael Ryan got the Tipperary job a year in advance. Before Eamon O'Shea stepped down in 2015. And there were misgivings, again, how can you appoint someone a year out? But he went and won the All-Ireland title in his first year in 2016. But I don't remember anything really like that where someone is just in a... And Mick McCarthy is essentially a caretaker manager here.
Yeah.
I think if people go back to last November when this all happened, when they clearly decided Mick was coming back, they realised very quickly that this was not going to, sate the whispering classes, if you like. And Stephen Kenny had done such a job with Dundalk. There was this appetite to see him get some kind of a role, and they offered him the under-21 role in isolation.
Yeah.
And he said no.
Yeah.
And rightly said no. So this was kind of very much make it up as you go along. Mm. And what I'd love to hear, and I'm not sure we will ever hear it, was when was this news broken to Mick? Because Mick was obviously told, yeah, you're coming back. Oh, sorry. We're going to do it this way.
Yeah.
You're getting 2 years. And then Stephen Kenny is coming in. And there has been a suggestion that there was a compensation package agreed with Mick to accept that. But what's really disconcerting to me is reading Richard's quotes here about players, how they'll throw managers under the bus. And we all have heard this comparison that Stephen Kenny, brilliant with League of Ireland, brilliant with underage, can he manage senior professionals? Because this is what happened with Brian Kerr, who I always remember that day in the Shelburne when he was introduced to the media, and there was just such a feel-good factor. This was right. Brian Kerr, Noel O'Reilly, it's their time. They really know what they're doing. But the senior players weren't really bothered by them. They weren't really willing to listen. They weren't really willing to sit in on lengthy video sessions
and
from people who hadn't played professional football. And there's a quote here from Richard.
Yeah.
Players are always looking for an excuse and a way out. That is the way with footballers. We are always looking to blame somebody else, and they can throw a manager under a bus at times.
And he says, to back up your point, Brian was a manager who did amazingly well at underage level, and I have full respect for him, but he never coached that really, really high level, so there is a difference. He says, for all the in-depth analysis and checking teams and looking at formations, there is a level of knowledge which you get from playing at that next level.
Now, if that's your mindset before he does anything, he hasn't a hope.
He's certainly on the back foot, yeah.
Isn't it? There's some irony there that professional players don't want to sit in on lengthy video analysis, which you would think, well, that's what they should be doing in some respects, that they obviously want to cut it.
Yeah.
Get out of there quick as possible, move on. Maybe it was the fact that they didn't rate them, that they didn't want to sit through it. But it just strikes me that, this is just, let's move on and let's get on with it.
Now, by the same token, a big name player going in as manager is quickly found out as well by the players if he doesn't do his homework and if he isn't on top of things. And I'd have no issue with Kenny actually taking this job. I think what he did with Dundalk in Europe, there's enough there to hang your hat on.
Mm.
But this succession plan, I totally agree with you, Vincent. I said it at the time. I did it like 3 or 4 nights in a row here and was just told if he'll just shut up, like let it go. But it was such a stroke, the succession plan. It was, because if you remember the way, and this sounds quite tame by what's happened since the FAI, but at the time, Brian Kerr was on and saying, like, the FAI board has kind of made a mess of this whole thing. It was the end of Keane and O'Neill. There was a sense the game's been mismanaged, the board, we need to look at it, we need to look at John Delaney. This was a big thing to be saying at the time. And this was, I think, get to Euro 2020, get Mick in. You get a lot of the recent former pros on side that way. They're big Mick fans. And equally, you satisfy... Who were John Delaney's biggest critics at the time? The League of Ireland supporters, the real kind of core fan base supporters who are behind the goal singing at Ireland matches, who are, you know, Delaney says the league's a problem child. This was just a manoeuvre to satisfy everyone.
This was a John Delaney appointment, yeah.
It feels that way. And it seems Stephen Kenny also, he quite rightly negotiated with that knowledge.
100%,
and he said, no, it's in writing, I get the job on this day. So that's how we've ended up with this situation. It may work, it may not work, but I don't think, even if it works, even if this works, I really don't think you can turn around and say the rationale behind the decision-making process was right. It wasn't.
No.
If you look at it in reverse now, instead of, you know, you're looking at it from last November and you're looking ahead, and from Mick McCarthy's point of view, I'm surprised he actually took an appointment like that was finally...
Well, I wonder at what stage he found out, though, as Vincent said.
Absolutely.
So but even to say, well, no matter how well I do here, I'm out. And I just to think that he took... He was appointed and he accepted the position
doesn't that maybe go to show that when he was first approached, odds are that was not on the cards. Mm-hmm. When he was first, like, if he was first approached with, you get 2 years and then you're out.
There was some doubt over that as that story ran over those few days over how long he was going to be there. I mean, he wasn't aware of it. Initially,
he was clearly, this was something that was thrown at him, having agreed to come back as Irish manager. And the suggestion is that when they decided to do this, and that Stephen Kenny was going to come in after 2 years, there was a compensation package agreed. So, just think about that. It's beyond farcical. That is their...
There's a couple of scenarios here is... You know, if they are successful and if they do qualify and have a reasonable campaign, and Mick has to set aside then, that puts immediate pressure on Stephen Kenny. Sure. Now, it may not work that way. It may be that they're out in the next few months and then he picks things up. But if it goes the other way and Mick McCarthy has to stand aside, that does put pressure on a manager who obviously hasn't been at that level before.
Well, what's also interesting is that Robbie Keane is part of Mick's management team, but Robbie Keane's contract is for longer than 2 years.
Yeah.
So Robbie will progress to be part of Stephen Kenny's management team. But Robbie is such a bond with Mick, and Robbie's whole international career came from Mick and picking him as a teenager, basically. You just wonder what's going to be the dynamic there, you know. How will Robbie and Stephen Kenny, will they see eye to eye? And what really makes me feel uncomfortable is you're getting these vibes. I see there's a line in this that some FAI insiders are uncomfortable with Stephen's ability to communicate.
Yeah, I don't know. That line is just in the piece, but it's not attributed to anyone.
No, really. But when you see a line like that, you're kind of wondering, where's this coming from? Are people already trying to pull little...
maneuvers.
Pull the rug from under Stephen Kenny, you know?
Well, they can't. It's in writing. And
yeah, absolutely.
You know, Stephen Kenny's well within his rights to say, this is the agreement, and I don't care.
And he will.
If I have to take the Euro 2020 trophy from Mick as I make my way into my job, I'm doing it. And he's dead right to it.
Stephen Kenny is made of tough stuff. He's not going to be messed around.
Like, it's a pity, because I do think Kenny deserves a shot, really genuinely. Yeah. But the circumstances were just... like, it's almost like the final parting blow of that FAI board is to give you this big, horrible, messy problem which is going to cause a lot of friction and issues potentially down the line. It's like they're, you know, appropriate that they've signed off in such fashion.
Isn't it bizarre to think it was only last November all this was happening?
Yeah.
And
it has been obviously clouded over by what happened in March with the FAI at administrative level, so it got lost in that. But I just think Richard Dunn coming out and saying that now highlights it and brings it back into focus, very much so, the almost immediacy of it.
Yeah. Right, you guys got to go to Croke Park, so you should go and we should wrap this up. By the way, just Because I mentioned them earlier, the exactly O'Cullen quotes, if you're interested, Peter O'Reilly has it, it's in all the newspapers, they all have it. So he's saying things like, there were things that didn't go right at the end of the season, Cullen said after Leinster's pre-season win over Coventry. When you get a group of guys who are out celebrating, blowing off steam at the end of the season, there are things that we can control better ourselves and that we will try to do moving forward. We weren't happy the way that we probably handled it ourselves. We could probably be better with having someone there to keep an eye on them. It's important players are allowed to go out and celebrate, but they're being judged by slightly differently to the rest of the general public. That's the way it is. We weren't happy the way we probably handled it ourselves. That's all Cullen's saying about it. It's not massively in-depth. I suspect there's a few questions at the end of the match and it came up again. You'll probably be asked about it again because there'll be a, well, what, when you say you weren't happy with how you handled it, what exactly do you mean?
Exactly.
You know,
it's unusual to think that a professional sportsman would need chaperoning like that. That's what jumps out there. Can they not trust our players, obviously, to go out and have a night? Maybe.
Recent history suggests.
Yeah.
Chaperoning period is maybe needed. Anyway. Lads, thanks so much for doing that. I'm sure people will be reading your extensive coverage and thoughts in tomorrow's Irish Independent. Enjoy it. Vincent Hogan, Colin Keyes, thanks so much.
Thanks, Joe.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.